Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. 100 years ago this last week, Leo Max Frank, a Jewish employer of child labor, was executed for the sex murder of his 13-year-old employee, Mary Fagan. The controlled media have published literally hundreds of articles, dramas, and documentaries on the case in recent weeks, and it looks like the flood will continue unabated all this year. The theme they endlessly repeat is this: Leo Frank was innocent, and his arrest, indictment, trial, and conviction were all motivated by anti-Semitism. Recently retired Jewish ADL boss Abraham Foxman even went on record saying that Leo Frank was, quote, convicted without evidence, close quote. But there is a mountain of evidence proving Leo Frank is guilty. Good enough for the coroner's jury, the grand jury, which included four Jews, the trial jury, the Georgia Court of Appeals, the U.S. Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court of the United States. If you sincerely think that these were all motivated by anti-Semitism, then you are truly paranoid. The Jews make up these falsehoods, including the totally fabricated tale of a murderous mob outside the courtroom threatening the jury with death, which appears in no contemporary account. And then they cite each other's lies to give a pseudo-scholarly sheen to the thrust of their central narrative: good Jews versus bad Yahoos. Today, we continue with part two of the new audiobook by Vanessa Neubauer, based on the series published in the American Mercury by Bradford L. Huey. On the 100th anniversary of the death of Leo Frank, we offer you 100 Reasons Leo Frank is Guilty, Part 2. I give you Miss Vanessa Neubauer.
38. Former county policeman Boots Rogers, who drove the officers to Frank's home and then took them all, including Frank, back to the factory on the morning of April 27th, said Frank was so nervous that he was hoarse, even before being told of the murder. Atlanta, Georgian, May 8, 1913. Quote, Rogers tells what police found at the factory. End quote. 39. Rogers also states that he personally inspected Newt Lee's time slip, the one that Leo Frank at first said had no misses, but later claimed the reverse. The Atlanta Georgian on May 8th reported what Rogers saw. Quote, Rogers said he looked at the slip and the first punch was at 6:30 and last at 2:30. There were no misses, he said. End quote. Frank, unfortunately, was allowed to take the slip and put it in his desk. Later, a slip with several punches missing would turn up. How can this be reconciled with the behavior of an innocent man? 40. The curious series of events surrounding Lee's time slip is totally inconsistent with the theory of a police, quote, frame-up, end quote, of Leo Frank. At the time these events occurred, suspicion was strongly directed at Lee and not at Frank. 41. When Leo Frank accompanied the officers to the police station later on during the day after the murder, Rogers stated that Leo Frank was literally so nervous that his hands were visibly shaking. 42. Factory foreman Lemmy Quinn would eventually testify for the defense that Leo Frank was calmly sitting in his office at 12:20, a few minutes after the murder probably occurred. As to whether this visit really happened, there is some question. Quinn says he came to visit Schiff, Frank's personal assistant, who wasn't there. Was he even expected to be there on a Saturday and holiday? And stayed only 2 minutes or so talking to Frank in the office. Frank at first said there was no such visit and only remembered it days later when Quinn, quote, refreshed his memory, end quote. 43. As reported by the Atlanta Georgian, City Detective John Black said even Quinn initially denied that there was such a visit. Quote, question. What did Mr. Quinn say to you about his trip to the factory Saturday? Answer. Mr. Quinn said he was not at the factory on the day of the murder. Question. How many times did he say it? Answer. Two or three times. I heard him tell Detective Starnes that he had not been there. End quote. Atlanta Georgian, May 8, 1913. Quote, Black testifies Quinn denied visiting factory. End quote. 44. Several young women and girls testified at the inquest that Frank had made improper advances toward them, in one instance touching a girl's breast and in another appearing to offer money for compliance with his desires. The Atlanta Georgian reported, quote, girls and women were called to the stand to testify that they had been employed at the factory or had had occasion to go there, and that Frank had attempted familiarities with them. Nellie Pettis of 9 Oliver Street declared that Frank had made improper advances to her. She was asked if she had ever been employed at the pencil factory. No, she answered. Question. Do you know Leo Frank? Answer. I have seen him once or twice. Question. When and where did you see him? Answer. In his office at the factory whenever I went to draw my sister-in-law's pay. Question. What did he say to you that might have been improper on any of these visits? Answer. He didn't exactly say. He made gestures. I went to get my sister's pay about 4 weeks ago, and when I went into the office of Mr. Frank, I asked for her. He told me I couldn't see him unless, quote, I saw him first, end quote. I told him I didn't want to, quote, see him, end quote. He pulled a box from his desk. It had a lot of money in it. He looked at it significantly and then looked at me. When he looked at me, he winked. As he winked, he said, quote, how about it? End quote. I instantly told him I was a nice girl. Here the witness stopped her statement. Coroner Donahue asked her sharply, quote, didn't you say anything else? End quote. Quote, yes, I did. I told him to go to hell, and walked out of his office. End quote. Atlanta Georgian, May 9th, 1913. Quote, Fagan case to be rushed to grand jury by Dorsey. End quote. 45. In the same article, another young girl testified to Frank's pattern of improper familiarities. Quote, Nellie Wood, a young girl, testified as follows. Question. Do you know Leo Frank? Answer. I worked for him 2 days. Question. Did you observe any misconduct on his part? Answer. Well, his actions didn't suit me. He'd come around and put his hands on me when such conduct was entirely uncalled for. Question. Is that all he did? Answer. No. He asked me one day to come into his office, saying that he wanted to talk to me. He tried to close the door, but I wouldn't let him. He got too familiar by getting so close to me. He also put his hands on me. Question. Where did he put his hands? Answer. He barely touched my breast. He was subtle in his approaches and tried to pretend that he was joking. But I was too wary for such as that. Question. Did he try further familiarities? Answer. Yes. End quote. 46. In May, around the time of disgraced Pinkerton detective McWorth's attempt to plant fake evidence, which caused McWorth's dismissal from the Pinkerton agency, attorney Thomas Felder made his loud but mysterious appearance. Colonel Felder, as he was known, was soliciting donations to bring yet another private detective agency into the case, Pinkerton's great rival, the William Burns Agency. Felder claimed to be representing neighbors, friends, and family members of Mary Fagan. But Mary Fagan's stepfather, J.W. Coleman, was so angered by this misrepresentation that he made an affidavit denying there was any connection between him and Felder. It was widely believed that Felder and Burns were secretly retained by Frank supporters. The most logical interpretation of these events is that, having largely failed in getting the Pinkerton Agency to perform corrupt acts on behalf of Frank, Frank's supporters decided to covertly bring another, and hopefully more cooperative, agency into the case. Felder and his unselfish efforts were their cover. Felder's representations were seen as deception by many, which led more and more people to question Frank's innocence. Atlanta, Georgian, May 15, 1913. Quote, Burns investigator will probe slaying. End quote. 47. Felder's efforts collapsed when A.S. Colyar, a secret agent of the police, used a dictograph to secretly record Felder offering to pay $1,000 for the original Coleman affidavit and for copies of the confidential police files on the Mary Fagan case. C.W. Toby, the Burns detective brought into the case by Felder, was reportedly present. Colyar stated that after this meeting, quote, I left the Piedmont Hotel at 10:55 a.m., and Toby went from thence to Felder's office, as he informed me, to meet a committee of citizens, among whom were Mr. Hirsch, Mr. Myers, Mr. Greenstein, and several other prominent Jews in this city. End quote. Atlanta, Georgian, May 21, 1913. Quote, T.B. Felder repudiates report of activity for Frank. End quote. 48. Felder then lashed out wildly, vehemently denied working for Frank's friends, and declared that he thought Frank guilty. He even made the bizarre claim, impossible for anyone to believe, that the police were shielding Frank. It was observed of Felder that, quote, when one's reputation is near zero, one might want to attach oneself to the side one wants to harm in an effort to drag them down as you fall. End quote. Atlanta, Georgian, May 21, 1913. Quote, T.B. Felder repudiates report of activity for Frank. End quote. 49. Interestingly, C.W. Toby, the Burns man, also made a statement shortly afterward, when his firm initially withdrew from the case, that he had come to believe in Frank's guilt also. Quote, it is being insinuated by certain forces that we are striving to shield Frank. That is absurd. From what I developed in my investigation, I am convinced that Frank is the guilty man. End quote. Atlanta Constitution, May 27, 1913. Quote, Burns Agency quits the Fagan case. End quote. 50. As his efforts crashed to earth, Felder made this statement to an Atlanta Constitution reporter. Quote, is it not passing strange that the city detective department, whose wages are paid by the taxpayers of this city, should hobnob daily with the Pinkerton Detective Agency, an agency confessedly employed in this investigation to work in behalf of Leo Frank? That they would take this agency into their daily and hourly conference and repose it in their confidence, and cooperate with it in every way possible, and withhold their cooperation from W.J. Burns and his able assistants, who are engaged by the public and for the public in ferreting out this crime. End quote. But what Felder failed to mention was that the Pinkertons' main agent in Atlanta, Harry Scott, had proved that he could not be corrupted by the National Pencil Company's money. So it is reasonable to conclude that the well-heeled pro-Frank forces would search elsewhere for help. The famous William Burns Agency was really the only logical choice. To think that Felder and, quote, Mary Fagan's neighbors, end quote, were selflessly employing Burns is naive in the extreme. It means that Frank's wealthy friends would just sit on their money and stick with the not-at-all-helpful Pinkertons, who had just fired the only agent who tried to help Frank. Atlanta Constitution, May 25, 1913. Quote, Thomas Felder brands the charges of bribery diabolical conspiracy. End quote. 51. Colyar, the man who exposed Felder, also stated that Frank's friends were spreading money around to get witnesses to leave town or make false affidavits. The Atlanta Georgian commented on Felder's antics as he exited the stage. Quote, "It is regarded as certain that Felder is eliminated entirely from the Fagan case. It had been believed that he really was in the employ of the Frank defense up to the time that he began to bombard the public with statements against Frank and went on record in saying he believed in the guilt of Frank." End quote. Atlanta Georgian, May 26, 1913. Quote, "Lay bribery effort to Frank's friends." End quote. 52. When Jim Conley finally admitted he wrote the death notes found near Mary Fagan's body, Leo Frank's reaction was powerful. Quote, "Leo M. Frank was confronted in his cell by the startling confession of the Negro sweeper James Connolly." Quote, "What have you to say to this?" End quote, demanded a Georgian reporter. Frank, as soon as he had gained the import of what the Negro had told, jumped back in his cell and refused to say a word. His hands moved nervously and his face twitched as though he were on the verge of a breakdown, but he absolutely declined to deny the truth of the Negro's statement or make any sort of comment upon it. His only answer to the repeated questions that were shot at him was a negative shaking of the head or the simple, quote, "I have nothing to say," end quote. Atlanta Georgian, May 26, 1913. Quote, "Negro sweeper says he wrote Fagan notes," end quote. 53. When Jim Conley reenacted, step by step, the sequence of events as he experienced them on the day of the murder, including the exact positions in which the body was found and detailing his assisting Leo Frank in moving Mary Fagan's body and writing the death notes, Harry Scott of the Pinkerton Detective Agency stated, quote, "There is not a doubt but that the Negro is telling the truth, and it would be foolish to doubt it. The Negro couldn't go through the actions like he did unless he had done this just like he said," end quote, said Harry Scott. Quote, "We believe that we have at last gotten to the bottom of the Fagan mystery," end quote. Atlanta Georgian, May 29th, 1913, extra. Quote, "Conley reenacts in plant part he says he took in slaying," end quote. 54. In early June, Felder's name popped up in the press again. This time, he was claiming that his nemesis, A.S. Colyar, had in his possession an affidavit from Jim Conley confessing to the murder of Mary Fagan, and that Colyar was withholding it from the police. The police immediately sweated Conley to see if there was any truth in this, but Conley vigorously denied the entire story and stated that he had never even met Colyar. Chief of Police Lanford said this confirmed his belief that Felder had been secretly working for Frank all along. Quote, "I attribute this report to Colonel Felder's work," end quote, said the chief. Quote, "It merely shows again that Felder is in league with the defense of Frank, that the attorney is trying to muddy the waters of this investigation to shield Frank and throw the blame on another." This first became noticeable when Felder endeavored to secure the release of Conley. His ulterior motive, I am sure, was the protection of Frank. He had been informed that the Negro had this damaging evidence against Frank, and Felder did all in his power to secure the Negro's release. He declared that it was a shame that the police should hold Conley, an innocent Negro. He protested strenuously against it. Yet not one time did Felder attempt to secure the release of Newt Lee or Gordon Bailey on the same grounds, even though both of these Negroes had been held longer than Conley. This, to me, is significant of Felder's ulterior motive in getting Conley away from the police. End quote. Are such underhanded shenanigans on the part of Frank's team the actions of a truly innocent man? Atlanta Georgian, June 6, 1913. Quote, "Conley, grilled by police again, denies confessing killing." End quote. 55. Much is made by Frank partisans of Georgia Governor Slayton's 1915 decision to commute Frank's sentence from death by hanging to life imprisonment. But when Slayton issued his commutation order, he specifically stated that he was sustaining Frank's conviction and the guilty verdict of the judge and jury. Quote, "In my judgment, by granting a commutation in this case, I am sustaining the jury, the judge, and the appellate tribunals, and at the same time, am discharging that duty which is placed on me by the Constitution of the state." End quote. He also added of Jim Conley's testimony that Frank had admitted to killing Mary Fagan and enlisted Conley's help in moving the body. Quote, "It is hard to conceive that any man's power of fabrication of minute details could reach that which Conley showed, unless it be the truth." End quote. 56. On May 8, 1913, the coroner's inquest jury, a panel of six sworn men, voted with the coroner 7-0 to bind Leo Frank over to the grand jury on the charge of murder after hearing the testimony of 160 witnesses. 57. On May 24, 1913, after hearing evidence from prosecutor Hugh Dorsey and his witnesses, the grand jury charged Leo M. Frank with the murder of Mary Fagan. Four Jews were on the grand jury of 21 persons. Although only 12 votes were needed, the vote was unanimous against Frank. An historian specializing in the history of antisemitism, Albert Lindemann, denies that prejudice against Jews was a factor and states that the jurors, quote, "were persuaded by the concrete evidence that Dorsey presented," end quote. And this indictment was handed down even without hearing any of Jim Conley's testimony, which had not yet come out. Lindemann, The Jew Accused, Three Anti-Semitic Affairs, Cambridge, 1993, page 251. 58. On August 25, 1913, after more than 29 days of the longest and most costly trial in Southern history up to that time, and after two of the South's most talented and expensive attorneys and a veritable army of detectives and agents in their employ gave their all in defense of Leo M. Frank, and after 4 hours of jury deliberation, Frank was unanimously convicted of the murder of Mary Fagan by a vote of 12-0. 59. The trial judge, Leonard Strickland Roan, had the power to set aside the guilty verdict of Leo Frank if he believed that the defendant had not received a fair trial. He did not do so, effectively making the vote 13-0. 60. Judge Roan also had the power to sentence Frank to the lesser sentence of life imprisonment, even though the jury had not recommended mercy. On August 26, 1913, Judge Roan affirmed the verdict of guilt and sentenced Leo Frank to death by hanging. 61. On October 31, 1913, the court rejected a request for a new trial by the Leo Frank defense team and re-sentenced Frank to die. The sentence handed down by Judge Benjamin H. Hill was set to be carried out on Frank's 30th birthday, April 17, 1914. 62. Supported by a huge fundraising campaign launched by the American Jewish community and supported by a public relations campaign carried out by innumerable newspapers and publishing companies nationwide, Leo Frank continued to mount a prodigious defense even after his conviction, employing some of the most prominent lawyers in the United States. From August 27, 1913 to April 22, 1915, they filed a long series of appeals to every possible level of the United States court system, beginning with an application to the Georgia Superior Court. That court rejected Frank's appeal as groundless. 63. The next appeal by Frank's dream team of world-renowned attorneys was to the Georgia Supreme Court. It was rejected. 64. A second appeal was then made by Frank's lawyers to the Georgia Supreme Court, which was also rejected as groundless. 65. The next appeal by Frank's phalanx of attorneys was to the United States Federal District Court, which also found Frank's arguments unpersuasive and turned down the appeal, affirming that the guilty verdict of the jury should stand. 66. Next, the Frank legal team appealed to the highest court in the land, the United States Supreme Court, which rejected Frank's arguments and turned down his appeal. 67. Finally, Frank's army of counselors made a second appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, which was also rejected, allowing Leo Frank's original guilty verdict and sentence of death for the murder by strangulation of Mary Fagan to stand. Every single level of the United States legal system, after carefully and meticulously reviewing the trial testimony and evidence, voted in majority decisions to reject all of Leo Frank's appeals and to preserve the unanimous verdict of guilt given to Frank by Judge Leonard Strickland Roan and by the 12-man jury at his trial, and to affirm the fairness of the legal process, which began with Frank's binding over an indictment by the 7-man coroner's jury and 21-man grand jury. 68. It is preposterous to claim that these men and all these institutions, North and South, the coroner's jury, the grand jury, the trial jury, and the judges of the trial court, the Georgia Superior Court, the Georgia Supreme Court, the U.S. Federal District Court, and the United States Supreme Court, were motivated by anti-Semitism in reaching their conclusions. 69. Even in deciding to commute Frank's sentence to life imprisonment, Governor John Slayton explicitly affirmed Frank's guilty verdict. He explained that only the jury was the proper judge of the meaning of the evidence and the veracity of the witnesses placed before it. He said in the commutation order itself, quote, many newspapers and non-residents have declared that Frank was convicted without any evidence to sustain the verdict. In large measure, those giving expression to this utterance have not read the evidence and are not acquainted with the facts. The same may be said regarding many of those who are demanding his execution. In my judgment, no one has a right to an opinion who is not acquainted with the evidence in the case, and it must be conceded that those who saw the witnesses and beheld their demeanor upon the stand are in the best position as a general rule to reach the truth. End quote. 70. In May of 1915, the Georgia State Prison Board voted 2-1 against a clemency petition, which, even if successful, would not have changed the guilty verdict of Leo M. Frank. 71. In 1982, Alonzo Mann, who in 1913, at 13 years old, had been the office boy for the National Pencil Company, made a sensation in the press by denying the sworn testimony he had made at the Leo Frank trial, and stating his belief that Jim Connolly was the real killer of Mary Fagan. In 1913, Mann had testified that he left the office on the day of the murder at 11:30 a.m. In 1982, he changed the time and told a quite different story as follows. Mann said that he left the factory at noon, half an hour later than in his testimony. It was Confederate Memorial Day, and a parade and other festivities were scheduled. Mann was to meet his mother, he says, but could not find her and, quote, returned to work, end quote, shortly after noon. When he entered the building, he says, he saw Jim Connolly carrying the limp body of a girl on the first floor. Quote, he wheeled on me, and in a voice that was low but threatening, he said, quote, if you ever mention this, I'll kill you, end quote. Mann claims he then left the building and ran home, telling his mother what he'd seen. Mann says that his parents advised him to keep silent to avoid publicity. And he did keep silent for many, many years. Jim Connolly is reported to have died in 1957. Another report says 1962. And presumably his death threat did not survive his demise. There are several problems with Mann's story. First, if true, it proves only that at some point Connolly was carrying Fagan's body by himself, without Frank's help. Connolly already admits this, though he says that he found the body too heavy for himself alone while still on the second floor, and that the elevator brought them directly to the basement. So Mann's story really doesn't address anything except two minor details of Connolly's testimony, neither of which are determinative of guilt. Mann was poor, suffering with a heart condition, and facing considerable medical expenses when he went public with his claims. 72. Why would a 13-year-old Alonzo Mann, quote, return to work, end quote, on a holiday if he didn't have to? And why, quote, return to work, end quote, if he apparently wasn't even scheduled to do so? Were office boys permitted to make their own hours in 1913? When other workers, such as Mary Fagan, for example, hadn't sufficient supplies in their department, they were immediately laid off until the supplies came in. Surely such economy would dictate that office boys would only come in when authorized and asked to do so. 73. If Alonzo Mann had such a definite appointment to meet his mother in town, so definite as to cause him to return to work after just a few minutes when he failed to immediately find her, why, then, was she waiting at home just a few minutes after that? 74. Why would white parents, like Alonzo Mann's, in the racially conscious and segregated Atlanta, Georgia of 1913, tell their white son not to tell the police about a guilty black murderer, when the result of not telling the police would ultimately result in an innocent, clean-cut white man, Leo Frank, the man who gave their son a highly prized job, going to the gallows as an innocent man? 75. And why would Alonzo Mann's parents then allow their 13-year-old son to report to work at the huge and cavernous National Pencil Company factory on Monday morning, April 28, 1913? 2 days after he was threatened with death by a murderer carrying a dead or dying white girl on his shoulder. Knowing that the murderer would still be there, and knowing that there were many dark and secluded places in said factory where their son might come to harm. Jim Conley reported back to work that Monday, as did Alonzo Mann and the approximately 170 other employees, who were naturally expected to be back at work after the holiday weekend. Jim Conley was not arrested until the first day of May. 76. If Alonzo Mann really walked in on Jim Conley carrying Mary Fagan's body a few minutes after noon, and then turned around and left the building, why didn't he see Montine Stover? 77. If Jim Conley really attacked Mary Fagan at the foot of the stairs, as Alonzo Mann suggests, why didn't Leo Frank hear her scream or any sounds of a struggle? He was only 40 feet away.
For Jews, the narrative of the Frank case promotes their ancient us versus them paradigm, which builds Jewish racial consciousness and forms a bulwark against assimilation with their hosts. In addition, it is an integral part of the promotion of white guilt. In this case, guilt for non-existent anti-Semitism and persecution of Jews. That is a major plank in their campaign to demoralize us. Next week, we'll conclude this exposé of the hoaxes and deceptions used by the Jewish power structure in the Leo Frank case, right here on American Dissident Voices. You've been listening to American Dissident Voices, the radio program of the National Alliance, founded by William Luther Pierce in 1970. This program is published every week at whitebiocentrism.com and nationalvanguard.org. You can join and support us by visiting natall.com. That's natall.com. Or write to National Alliance, Box 172, Laurel Bloomery, Tennessee, 37680, USA. We welcome your support, your inquiries, and your help in spreading our message of hope to our people. Once again, that address is Box 172, Laurel Bloomery, Tennessee, 37680, USA. Until next week, this is Kevin Alfred Strom reminding you to keep on thinking free.
For blood and for soil, we will work, we will toil. Heaven is born on the earth. The heroes arise as we shout to the skies. We will now have our rebirth. For blood and for soil, we will work, we will toil. Heaven is born on the earth. The heroes arise as we shout to the skies. We will now have. Shout to the sky.